first case this morning is Scherer v. L.A. Weight Loss Centers.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Joan Mannix, and together with Mr. Carlson and Mr. Hart, we represent Carolyn Scherer, who is the representative and the sister of Pamela Hobby. This case was driven in the district court by the district court's decision that Dr. DeRosso, the testimony of plaintiff's expert, his testimony and his opinions regarding a causal relationship between the LA weight loss supplements prescribed, for lack of a better word, and sold to Pamela Hobby were not sufficient to establish a causal relationship with her ultimate development of liver failure and her death. It's hard to imagine what more you could want in an effort to get past a district court in its gatekeeper role. There was a consensus among every expert who testified, all of Hobby's treating physicians, Dr. Hayashi, Dr. Fecht, Dr. Beffler, and amazingly, an agreement with Dr. Watkins, the defendant's own expert. They all agreed about the facts that should be considered in determining whether there was a causal relationship between Pamela Hobby's ingestion of the LA weight loss supplements and her development of acute liver failure. They all agreed on the methodology for considering that information and determining whether those facts, when considered together, drove a conclusion. The only point of disagreement is the conclusions reached based on consideration of the same facts under the same methodology. The methodology that's used, and again, this was supported as much by Dr. DeRosso's testimony as by Dr. Watkins' testimony, defendant's expert, is that in determining, hepatologists determine the causation of liver failure by applying what's called the Russell-Uclef Causality Assessment Method, or RUCAM. This method essentially integrates both the concepts of general and specific causation. And in this case, both Dr. DeRosso and plaintiff's treating physicians, whose testimony was not stricken, all reached the conclusion that Pamela Hobby died as a result of drug-induced liver failure. The drugs that induced the liver failure were the hepatotoxic compounds contained in the LA Weight Loss supplement she was sold by LA Weight Loss. Those included chromium, an herbal supplement called Hoshu, and also known by about eight other names.
Those conclusions were based on a combination of the doctor's differential diagnosis, as I understand it, along with some case studies that were reported in medical journals or articles, but not any, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this correctly, epidemiological studies. And that's what the district court rested its Daubert decision on, as I understand his reasoning. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that that's a very fair assessment. He essentially looked to the absence of epidemiological studies and found that there was no general causation and therefore there was no specific causation. Again, he ignored essentially the undisputed testimony of all of the experts who had anything to say about liver toxicity, liver causes, and specifically the cause of Pamela Hoppe's liver disease and failure.
It's my understanding also that the experts were all in agreement that there are no epidemiological studies available on this particular disorder or medical reaction, and therefore this is the only evidence that's available. So does this case come down to the question of whether case studies and differential diagnosis as a matter of law is sufficient to get past the Daubert gatekeeping analysis as a matter of law?
It is correct that there were no epidemiological studies, and so this case is distinguishable from cases where you have experts who are seeking to testify in contradiction to epidemiological studies, disproving a relationship between a causative agent and an illness. I don't believe that this case requires the court to make a general finding that case reports in the absence of epidemiological studies and a differential diagnosis require as a matter of law that meets the gatekeeping role. I do, however, think under the circumstances presented in this case where there's no question about the methodology that experts in this field apply, and it's a little bit more complicated than just differential diagnosis, but that is a very significant part of that, and I'll talk about that in a second, that where all of the experts in a field agree, this is the information you look at, and this is the way you analyze that information to come to a conclusion, with the exception that Dr. Watkins, he follows right down the same line we do, except he says, the biopsy. I put all my weight on the biopsy. And there's a lot of evidence that the biopsy is at best equivocal. That where you have a situation where there's this consensus on what facts you look at, how you look at them and analyze them, then the gatekeeping function is met. In this case, there was, in addition to the differential diagnosis, which involved the elimination of all other, and again, we have an agreement on this, all other causes of liver failure other than a possible drug-induced liver failure or autoimmune-induced liver failure. There is a temporal relationship between, there was evidence that she had no indicia of liver dysfunction or any problems prior to her ingestion of the LA weight loss supplements. You have evidence that within 90 days, which is the time frame which the causality assessment, or RUCAM, uses to evaluate the possibility of a drug-induced liver failure, there's a temporal relationship between her ingestion of those substances and her development of liver failure. Liver failure symptoms, which were nausea, and then yellow eyes, and then very shortly after, within about 2 weeks from the beginning to the end, she's diagnosed as suffering from acute liver failure. You also have what to me is a dose-response relationship. It's not the typical feed them more and see if they get sicker or feed more people of something and see if they all get sick. It's a dose-response relationship to the extent that when the exposure to the LA weight loss supplements was removed, her reaction decreased. Her liver enzymes, which were an indicator of the illness or the dysfunction of her liver, decreased by 50% shortly after she was removed from that exposure, which I think is a dose. It's sort of a converse of a dose-response relationship.
Was the effect on other people taking this supplement brought into evidence?
I'm not sure I understand, Your Honor.
Did anybody else get sick?
Yes. There, obviously, that is where the case reports come in. There were case reports that all the case reports, incidentally, when you read through them, they follow the exact same analysis. These are, unlike, I guess, other case reports, these case reports looked at not just, isn't it interesting, they took this supplement and then they got sick. They looked at the temporal relationship, and they looked at also eliminating all other potential causes and performed essentially the same analysis in the case of the case reports and the individuals identified as having suffered injury as a result of the compounds, the same compounds that are at issue in this case. So there was that evidence from the case reports that other people had gotten sick. There is no doubt that this is a quote-unquote idiosyncratic reaction in that it is not necessarily dose-dependent, and clearly it is not arsenic so that everybody who takes it, you know, dies.
Would this expert testimony have been admissible in state court under the state court standard for admission of expert testimony?
I can't imagine how it could not. Under the Frye, at least in Illinois, we have Frye, which is basically looks solely at the methodology, and here the methodology, as I've discussed, was universally embraced by everybody.
So let's talk about your motion to remand.
Sure.
Once you moved to amend your complaint, the motion was granted by the magistrate judge, although apparently without his recognizing that there was a problem of non-diversity of two of the three added defendants. And then that decision was later revisited by the district court, and the motion or the order was vacated and the amended complaint was struck on fraudulent joinder doctrine grounds, as I understand the chronology here. But that was in connection with denying your motion to remand. Is that the right procedural chronology?
I'm sorry to interrupt. Yes, that's exactly what happened. Obviously, it was our position that once the motion to join Poole and Moore was granted without objection, and there's been a motion to supplement, but we think the record adequately demonstrates in its current state that there was no objection, and there was no sort of the magistrate judge just jumped the gun and didn't give them an opportunity to object. There was no objection.
Well, did the motion alert the magistrate judge that there were non-diverse parties?
No, it did not, Your Honor. But again, if the defendants had a problem with it, it would have been the defendants certainly could have raised that for the judge.
Did you name the two non-diverse parties in the motion?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. We specifically indicated that we would be adding Shani Poole and Courtney Moore, both of whom, as employees of LA Weight Loss, they certainly knew who they were and where they were from, and that they would destroy diversity.
So the defendants knew, but the magistrate judge did not.
That is correct, Your Honor.
How did the magistrate get involved anyway?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? How did the magistrate get involved?
Your Honor, I honestly don't know. I assume that the judge referred it to the magistrate judge for...
He referred it for him to
support
a recommendation?
I'm assuming that he referred that to the magistrate judge for his consideration. And I don't know what... I certainly will be happy to talk to Mr. Carlson, who's here, who was there, who can tell me more specifically. I'm sorry, I can't answer.
When you come back.
Thank you.
You're in your rebuttal time now.
Okay. I will reserve the rest of my time unless the court has any additional questions.
I do have one question about the basis for the addition of the two individual defendants, the non-diverse parties. The claims against them were stated in various alternatives, most of which I think are not actionable under Illinois law. With one exception, the one having to do with their participation in the development of the diet program for the plaintiff here, or the plaintiff's decedent. Would you address that?
Sure.
There was not a whole lot of attention paid to that in the briefing.
Both of those parties answered the complaint, and neither one of them asserted that we had failed to state a cause of action against them. Second, Poole and Moore were the individuals who prescribed this stuff for Pamela Hoppe, prescribed these supplements. They also, Poole was the supervisor, or the manager, I think her formal title was, of the LA Weight Loss Center, and she was charged with sort of overseeing that everything was being done appropriately, which in our case we submit that one she didn't do. She didn't have any concern, or her deposition bears out, she didn't have any concern or even curiosity about the safety of the supplements. Moreover, there was evidence that there was a supplement chart, and there was, this is all from Poole's deposition, there was a supplement chart that said these are how you prescribe these supplements. You're supposed to take two a day, one at breakfast, one at lunch. You're supposed to take three a day, one at lunch.
Right, but you're not alleging that they failed to follow the protocols that went with the provision of these supplements that were provided to them by LA Weight Loss.
I don't remember the specific allegations, but that is certainly one of the factual bases for our argument that they did, in fact, prescribe in contradiction to the written procedures and guidelines that LA Weight Loss itself had developed And again, I without having the Second Amendment complaint in front of me, I can't remember specifically what the allegations are, but that would certainly be one of the factual bases for seeking relief against them.
Well, I guess my question is, what independent duty do they have?
I think that they have an independent duty to comply with, to perform their jobs responsibly. And I'm not sure I understand what independent duty means in the sense that...
Well, to hold them personally liable, they have to have breached an independent duty owed to the plaintiff's decedent here, Pamela Hoppe.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that we've cited Illinois. That was certainly what the district court found, but under Illinois law...
Well, he really didn't, though. I mean, his ruling was wrong on the law as far as that's concerned, because he said... There's no basis for the only basis for liability here is vicarious liability of their employer, and that's not right. I mean, the agent or employee can have an independent duty in some circumstances in tort and be held personally liable for his or her own torts. But I'm asking you, what's your theory here as against these two individual defendants?
Essentially, that they were that they did have an obligation to treat their patient, Pamela Hoppe, with due care, and to prescribe medication for her that was consistent with the protocols established by LA Weight Loss, and at least with some cognizance, concern, or passing thought to the question of whether what they were giving her was safe.
Ms. Mannix, your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We'll give another minute to the appellee.
Efall, Your Honor. Your Honor, Andrew Efall on behalf of LA Weight Loss. Your Honor, in April 2004, Ms. Hoppe, the decedent in this case, signed up for LA Weight Loss diet program that included taking dietary supplements. Over 3 months later, at the end of August, over 3 months later, at the beginning of August, Ms. Hoppe was diagnosed with acute hepatitis and died at the end of the month. The appellant blames LA Weight Loss's dietary supplements, and as I've read these briefs and as I listened to argument today, there seems to be some confusion about the basic terminology and the scientific principles that I want to address initially, and then I will address some of the specific things that were raised in argument. The first thing that's clear from the case law is that general causation has to be established before specific causation. Both must be proven, but general comes before specific. As the court in Soldo versus Sandoz stated, if the plaintiff has not demonstrated sufficiently reliable evidence of general causation, her claims fail, and there's no need to consider specific causation. Here, the appellants have not shown general causation. Second, the appellant argues as if there is only a choice between case studies on one hand and a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind, clinical, epidemiological study on the other. And that's just not the case. In reality, there are many types of epidemiological studies. There's cohort studies, there's cross-sectional studies, there's animal studies, case-control, trend studies. Those are discussed in detail in textbooks. They're also discussed in detail in the Federal Manual of Scientific Evidence. Now, the randomized clinical trial is the most reliable, and it's the gold standard for establishing general causation on one hand. And on the other hand, case studies are the least reliable. They're purely anecdotal. They can't eliminate confounders, and at best, they just generate hypotheses. So there's a spectrum. Often, when establishing general causation, you'll see a combination, something in the middle or a combination. And that's what McLean versus Metabolite is talking about. Here, the appellants rely only on a few case studies. And as the McLean case says, they raise questions, they don't answer questions. The third sort of misnomer is the concept of a differential diagnosis. A differential diagnosis deals only with specific causation. And importantly to this case, it's largely the language of treating physicians who have to make treating decisions even in the absence of general causation. As the Southern District of Illinois found in Carriker versus Sandoz, a differential diagnosis in the absence of general causation may be used by treating physicians out of necessity, but has no place in the practice of science without the establishment of general causation. There's a myriad of other cases cited in our brief that hold that exact same thing in a little different way. Here, the appellant relies solely on a differential diagnosis with case studies. The fourth thing I'd like to point out, and this is very important because I don't think we gave it enough treatment in our brief, is the concept of an idiosyncratic response. Idiosyncratic denotes a hypersensitivity to a substance. It's rare, it's unpredictable, and most importantly, it's an individual response. We have cited Prosser, Law of Torts, Sections 96 and 102, and we've also cited the Illinois case of Presby versus Gillette. Both of them stand for the rule barring the idiosyncratic consumer from recovery, whether it's a case in strict liability, warranty, or negligence. If you have one person that reacts adversely and nobody else does, or maybe only one or two out of millions, then you don't get to recover. And that's what Gillette's about. Someone used deodorant, put it under their arms, they had an adverse skin reaction, they're the only person. The Gillette case says no recovery. The fifth thing is sort of the conflation of terms. The appellant uses the term potentially hepatotoxic to mean it can cause hepatitis. But potentially hepatotoxic is used by the experts in this case and is used in science means it might cause hepatitis. We don't know. It hasn't been tested. So here, when you look at the expert report, when you look at the deposition of Dr. Durazzo, he says each substance individually might be. You know, if you ground up the wood on this table and put it in my water and drink it, it's potentially hepatotoxic. We don't know. No one's probably ever done it.
You want to give it a shot?
I think that's
over the weekend, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think that's overstating it. There was more to his opinion than that.
There was more to his opinion. I'm simply talking, Your Honor, about the concept of potentially hepatotoxic, and I realize that they've looked at some other issues. The last evidence that I do want to, the last item I want to address here, Your Honor, is the evidence that Dr. Durazzo did look at and the conclusions he looked at. The appellant's expert, Dr. Durazzo, attempted to establish the source of her hepatitis by making a differential diagnosis and looking at case reports. He looked at 8 case reports. They're spread out across 5 substances. They weren't 8 case reports on Hoshu-Wu. They're 8 case reports about Hoshu-Wu, Gotu-Kola, chromium, niacinamide, and borage oil. Now, notably, the district court found that some of the articles didn't even deal necessarily with one of the 5 substances. Dr. Durazzo's opinion, after looking at this and doing his differential diagnosis, was as follows. I don't know. I couldn't tell which one exactly. Probably 1, 2, 3. It's difficult to tell. At best, Dr. Durazzo's opinion is a hypothesis. He even refused to make causal statements. The district court looked at Dr. Durazzo's testimony and set forth its findings. First of all, Hoshu-Wu might increase the risk of liver damage. Gotu-Kola might increase the risk of hepatitis. Chromium, no link. Niacinamide, no link. Borage oil, Dr. Durazzo couldn't tell what form that the plaintiff took. At the end of the day, we look at Dr. Durazzo's opinions, and he admits that he could not rule out autoimmune hepatitis. He could not rule out idiopathic hepatitis, meaning we don't know where it came from. One of the cases we cited for you, the Black case, cites an expert saying 10 to 15% of all hepatitis is idiopathic. He admits in his testimony that Ms. Hoppe's case met the criteria for probable, i.e. more likely than not, autoimmune hepatitis. He could not, looking at slides, describe for us the typical diagnostic features for hepatitis caused by any one of the five substances.
Counsel, if I could interrupt you at this point. We don't even get to the district court's evidentiary ruling if this case should have been in state court. So if you would address the district court's ruling striking the amended complaint that had previously been filed with permission of the magistrate judge and whether it was appropriate.
Certainly, Your Honor. Here, you have to look at both the joinder and you have to look at the remand. Now, the remand's looked at as de novo. A joinder, however, is permissive and is analyzed under an abuse of discretion standard. What Judge Steele did in this case is he looked at what Magistrate Proud did. Magistrate Proud determined that, well, rather, Judge Steele determined that Magistrate Proud had not gone through the required analysis when looking to do a joinder or not.
And you know the answer to the question I asked your opposing counsel, how did it get before the magistrate?
I don't know the answer. I can tell you I assume it's a sort of a routine. He thought it was a routine motion that magistrates often look at. So he looked at it.
Is there a standing order to refer him?
I don't know, Your Honor. The appellant has stated that, well, you know, this wasn't opposed. They put forth no evidence to show that anybody was aware that this destroyed diversity. But one thing is clear if you look at the record.
Well, these were your employees, or employees of your client, I should say, that they wanted to join. So presumably that knowledge is in your files.
I understand, Your Honor. One thing's for certain, though, when you look at the record, as soon as we became aware that there was a destruction of diversity, brought it to the court's attention. And what happened at that point is Judge Steele looked at what Magistrate Proud had done, and he came to the conclusion that Magistrate Proud had not gone through the four steps that he needed to go through when deciding to do a joinder. So Judge Steele went through those four steps.
Are you talking about the fraudulent joinder analysis?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because fraudulent joinder technically is inapplicable in this procedural context. Would you agree with that? That's a doctrine that applies when the case comes to the federal court on removal in the first instance, not a later joinder.
Say that one more time, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Fraudulent joinder is a doctrine that applies when the case is removed in the first instance, not to a situation where the case is already in federal court on a proper removal and there's a motion to amend with non-diverse parties that would destroy diversity.
In any case, Your Honor, I don't know whether I agree with that or not. I'd have to be honest with you. I'd have to look at it
a
little closer.
Well, it's kind of an important issue if this is an inapplicable doctrine. Now, perhaps the same factors apply on an equitable basis because the judge has to weigh the equities of whether to permit joinder
or
not.
Your Honor, I would submit that they do, first of all. Second of all, I would also state that a joinder is permissive. And Judge Steele looked at what was occurring and decided that the joinder should not have taken place.
Well, he made at least one legal mistake in that decision, it seems to me, when he said that the two individual defendants, as agents of LA Weight Loss, would not be personally liable for any tort they may have performed while working within the scope of their employment. That's wrong. Yeah, it may be that there were no cognizable claims alleged against them under Illinois law, but that's a different question. They can certainly be held liable for their own torts, whether they're committed in an employment setting or not. The fact that their employer can be vicariously liable for their torts doesn't eliminate their liability.
I don't disagree with that proposition.
So what do we do with that mistake?
Well, I think the court at least obliquely addressed that when they said, certainly there's the possibility that Moore and Poole did not act within the scope of their employment.
It doesn't matter about scope of employment. That just has to do with whether the employer can be held liable. That has nothing to do with their personal liability, whether they were or were not in the scope of their employment. If they committed independent torts, in other words, breached an independent duty that they owed to Ms. Hoppe, they are jointly and severally liable with their employer.
But, Your Honor, if you look at the complaint, there's nothing that's alleged or averred against Moore or Poole that would be an independent tort.
Well, what about the fact that they supervised and approved a diet plan that included the taking of these supplements in excess of the directions? You may be right on the failure to warn and so forth. That duty may not attach to them in the context of this case, but the complaint does allege that they were in charge of developing and approving a diet plan, and that they did so, and that they told Ms. Hoppe to take supplements in excess of the directions.
Well, Your Honor,
now, the facts may or may not bear that out, but that's what the allegation is.
When the plaintiffs responded with evidence in their reply for the motion to remand, they attached the evidence they had, first of all, which consisted of nothing more than a diet plan. I don't think the facts bear that out. And the second thing, before I stop here, Your Honor, is once again you go back to idiosyncratic reaction. If you have an idiosyncratic reaction, Illinois law is clear.
We don't.
It doesn't matter whether you're under Frye. It doesn't matter whether you're under Daubert.
That's a merits question. That's not a pleadings question. Did they allege a cognizable claim under Illinois law in that subsection of their amended complaint?
I don't believe they did, Your Honor.
And why not?
Well, you're kind of asking me to tell you the absence of something, and I just don't see it there. So I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer anything further than you look at the complaint. I don't see where they've alleged anything that's an independent tort. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Just briefly, back on the last point, Your Honor, Mr. Efall suggests there was no evidence of the record. First to Judge Caney's question. Apparently, pursuant to the local rules, this is information Mr. Carlson has supplied me, if it's a non-dispositive motion, it's referred automatically to the magistrate judge.
For report and recommendation or for decision?
My understanding, for decision, Your Honor.
You can tell her.
Your Honor, it can be a right to.
Well, I guess it depends whether it's a final order. That's what I'm getting at.
I understand. I mean, if it was a report and recommendation by the magistrate judge, they had 10 days, I believe, whether it's final or not, to object to it.
Well, we'll look at the record. You can go ahead.
Sure. And there's actually two bases. I've had also a chance to look at the Second Amendment complaint. I don't recall specifically what was attached to the remand motion, but the depositions of Moore and Poole are attached both to the motions for summary, our response to the motion for summary judgment, and our response to the motion to strike Dr. DeRosa's testimony. And Poole testified the allegations that Poole and Moore prescribed these supplements in contravention of LA Weight Loss's written policies is in Poole's testimony, I believe at like page 72, 73. There was also testimony, and this is an additional allegation that I think we have an independent duty sufficiently alleged with respect to, there was an obligation by Poole or Moore to refer the question of whether Pamela Hoppe could participate in the program to her treating physician because she had pre-existing issues and she was already on medication. And there was a requirement under LA Weight Loss's policies and procedures that under those kinds of circumstances they had to make contact with the treating doctor to make sure that the treating doctor didn't have an issue with it.
Thank you, Ms. Mannix.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement.